Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, March 11th, 2010. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz. I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, Money and Markets, and Ask Catherine, and then Franklin is going to join us for our Precious Metals Market Report and our wonderful documentary, Supersize Me, Morgan Spurlock's amazing documentary about eating for 30 days straight at McDonald's. Money and Markets. Our theme this evening is decentralizers have been busy. As I walk through Money and Markets, we're going to hear a lot about what the pro-centralization team is up to. So, you know, the pro-decentralization team has been busy, and we'll be back in the news in other weeks. Let me start with geopolitics and trade wars. We've reached a very interesting point in Iran. The U.S. efforts to achieve more draconian sanctions appear not to be working. We don't have the support we need from Russia and China. It's really a quagmire. It's going to be very interesting to see how the administration muddles through. We have continued squabbling, although it's settled down as a result of the Greek crisis. I put a very important chart up on the blog, which I recommend to you, that shows the inflows into equity mutual funds in the United States in January, followed in February literally by a hemorrhaging of money out. And that hemorrhaging coincides with an effort here in this country to literally spin and I would say orchestrate a crisis in Greece and with respect to the euro and European credits. And it wouldn't surprise me if what came out ultimately was that the crisis in Greece was in part engineered, and the the effort by the hedge funds to really tank the euro was an effort in part to stem the hemorrhaging of money leaving the U.S. markets, including the U.S. stock markets. But take a look at that chart. It's a very interesting one, and we see that spin sort of slowing down, and sure enough, the money, tiny bits of money, we now net positive flows into the U.S. equity mutual funds. But my prediction is what we were watching behind the scenes was a trade war for capital, and that trade war is going to continue to increase. We saw Icelanders in an amazing referendum, 93% plus, reject a bailout of depositors from the Netherlands and the U.K., getting high interest rate returns on ICESave in Iceland. And unfortunately, while, very reaffirming and feeling, the referendum is not binding on the government. The government has indicated they continue to negotiate a bailout. Clearly, the referendum, though, has put them in a much better negotiating position. But again, we see the capital trade wars going on and the tension between the people and the leadership. My guess is the 93% you saw in the Icelanders is not unlike what probably the percentage was in the United States that was against the bailouts. So we see the huge majority of people against the banks, but the banks continuing to win, at least for now. Swiss politicians, interestingly enough, one of the Swiss political parties has indicated that it does not support the UBS deal with the United States, and so the tensions between Switzerland and America continue. As I discussed last week, AIG continues to be sort of parsed out. I say now that AIG has finished its black budget dirty work in the financial coup d'etat. Its remnants are being parsed out to the old traditional insurance companies. And we saw another piece of AIG go out today or this week in another global deal. That's going to continue. A real trade war in the continuing theme of privatization. We have a German politician standing up and saying that Greece, to balance its budget, ought to sell its islands. I'm sure there are plenty of German investors who'd love to own Crete and Patmos and a few other very beautiful islands in the Aegean. Bad news or good news for mind control, Samsung has announced that it's going to launch this year 3D television in the UK. If it's coming out in the UK, it won't be long before it's in the United States. In part, they are affirmed by the success of the Avatar movie and the popularity of 3D. So watch for even more seductive TV technology coming our way. Okay, that's it for trade wars. Let's look at unemployment and personal income. We've had recent reports that unemployment growth has flattened, and we have unemployment holding at 14.9 million, 9.7% unemployment rate. Those are the official statistics. We see a very different story over at Shadow Stats. It's very important to understand that the Census Bureau is hiring over a million temporary workers, and so if unemployment is holding flat, it's holding flat with the help of the Census Department trying to hire over a million people, which is pretty amazing. We see just incredible incredible reports of the pain on the ground of people struggling with unemployment, and we have the King Report asking the question, very interesting this week, are unemployment benefits about to become permanent? Because we now have legislation supporting 99 weeks of unemployment benefits, and this is starting to turn into a structural presence. Turning to the federal markets, when I say the centralizers have been busy, they have really been busy at the federal level. We have the president absolutely committed in the face of a real deep opposition in the general population. The president committed to getting health care reform through, and the Democratic leadership committed to helping him do it. There's really a question of whether health care can make it through the House, and we can get a reconciliated bill out before everybody goes home to run for in the congressional races. So this is really going to be a hair raiser as to whether this gets passed or not. I'm going to talk tonight. I think it's really important to understand why a president would use so much of his political capital to get health care in the face of this kind of opposition. While the House grapples with health care, the Senate is grappling with financial reform. We saw the H.R. 4173, the Welfare Reform and Consumer Protection Acts, passed in the House, and it's going to the Senate. Chris Dodd, who has said he's not standing for re-election, has partnered with Bob Crocker of Tennessee, one of my senators, to try and get a bipartisan agreement in the Senate to get financial reform through. I have a special report on that, so I'm going to go into that when we reach the end of Money and Markets. Big question as to whether that can get passed. Again, I think less opposition in the general population, but great discomfort in the Republicans as to what the Democrats want to do. The Senate proposals being floated are a dilution of what came through in the House. Again, the health care and the financial reform together is a lot to push, it's a big pig to go through the snake. But both of them really augur tremendous and increased financial control and central control of the economy and of people's lives. We see John McCain, who has sponsored a bill to control supplements, and literally some said could put lots of supplement and healthcare practitioners literally out of business, back off and say he was not going to support it, but that bill has not been withdrawn. Another incredible centralizing force was we now see proposals of an immigration bill, or at least the theory is immigration is really the new pretext to do a national ID, this time saying that employers should be required to have their employees have RFID chips to ascertain and prove that they're not illegal aliens. God bless Ron Paul, one of our heroes tonight, got on Fox News yesterday and said the whole idea was nuts, which it is. Finally, gave a special report last week about the census, but I want to encourage you to go back and listen to it again. A new report this week that 72% of people complied with census reporting, or at least some of census reporting in the 2000 census. As I pointed out last week, it costs only $100 the penalty for not complying is $100. I would advise you that noncompliance and paying $100 is one of the best investments you'll make this year if you do it. That's it for federal government, except for one other thing that we'll get into in the precious metals report, and that is the debate about control reporting and use of swaps and derivatives to do all sorts of things, whether it's bring on the Greek financial crisis or manipulate the gold and precious metals market, is rising to the fore. So a big piece of financial reform is clearly derivatives and swaps and what's going on there. Moving to state and local government, as I said before, I think the real action this year in terms of what happens in the economy and what happens politically and whether, you know, as Tina Turner would say, we do this nice and or rough, is going to be at the state and local level. Interestingly enough, the head of PIMCO, CEO of PIMCO, formerly of Harvard Endowment, came out and said that the problems in state and local government, the financial problems, are much worse than anybody has understood or digested. And I agree. I think this year and next in the budget cycles, we're going to see a tremendous amount. Interestingly enough, the Kiplinger letter this Friday predicts that the commercial real estate market will be the toughest place in the economy. And when people ask me what I expect for the real estate market this year, I say let's look at what happens 2 months to the market 2 months after the state and local governments balance their budget. Many of them are June 30 or this summer. So, you know, by August, September, October, we should get a clear direction of what's happening in the state and local government, what that means to unemployment and income, and how hard it's going to hit the real estate market, which is very hard. We have a report that the sales tax, one of the most important vehicles for state and local government to fund themselves, sales tax rates have risen to their all-time high. And sure enough, Kiplinger tax letter predicts that taxes are going to go up, up, up. And that's part of the debate you're seeing, whether it's sneaky ways in Washington or at the state and local level. How are people going to balance their budgets? Some of it's going to be cutbacks. Kansas City, Missouri just announced that they're shutting down 50% of their schools and consolidating their school system into what was 50%. That's an extraordinary amount of schools shut down, and throughout rural and suburban America, the employment that comes out of schools is very, very significant in the economy. So these are really going to be hard hit. And for those of us who are property owners, remember, ultimately, it's our property that's on the line for the bonds and the budgets. Interestingly enough, tonight CBS News reported that 7 of 10 of the wealthiest counties in the country are in the Washington, D.C. area. Now, you guys have always heard my analogy of the body in trauma bringing the blood to the heart and lungs, and me complaining that instead we're bringing the blood to the toes and the fingers, and there's no better proof than literally Loudoun County is now the wealthiest county in the country. Not because they make lots of, you know, interesting products and services or grow lots of great food. It's because they're co-located with Washington, D.C., and all the federal contractors can afford, all the defense contractors can afford to buy big horse farms. Good news. One of the things, I had a wonderful entrepreneur call me from Texas today, and he said, my business is going gangbusters. And he said, somebody said to me today, this is the busiest slowdown we've ever seen. And he said to what he said to me really resonated, because I'm getting reports from all over the country that businesses that are very much in alignment with the long-term fundamental trends are holding their own, if not growing, despite all the economic challenges and ills. It's very important. I want to really stress this point. I'm going to keep coming back to it again and again. What happens when you have monetary policy of the kind that we're experiencing is it encourages people to focus their time and attention and to build businesses around things that make no sense. So we end up in bubbles building all sorts of overhead in our personal lives and in our businesses that do things that either harm other people or really are not that useful or essential. They're just you know, geared up by lots of borrowing, whether it's borrowing in the private markets or it's consumer debt or it's government having lots of programs financed with more government borrowing. And that's why it is very, very important in all the things you do in your professional life and your personal life to ask the question, is what I'm doing useful for people now and in the future? Is it in alignment, as Franklin Sanders says, with the long-term fundamental economic trends? Because if it's not, you know, it's very easy for the manipulators, for a change in government policy from on high, or the bursting of a bubble to just whipsaw you and destroy your business. So don't let hot money and government money encourage you into doing things that are out of alignment with the long-term trends, because you get completely you can wake up tomorrow and find your business absolutely wiped out. Okay, special report. I had my attorney go through what is now called the Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act of 2009, passed in the House, moving into the Senate. It really is 10 acts in one, rolled up into one. It's a huge financial reform package. I won't even give you the names of all the different acts. I often call the Patriot Act the Concentration and Control of Cash Flow Act. And literally what this financial reform package does is it rolls up everything that hasn't been controlled by the federal government and attempts to regulate and control it. Now, let's say you said to me, well, you know, we need financial reform. Financial reform is a good thing. What I would say is we have a problem. And we need to properly diagnose that problem. And once we've properly diagnosed that problem, we need to build real long-term solutions. Now, what you're looking at, I told you last week when I described this bill that I had a deputy at when I worked in the administration said that an auditor is someone who bayonets the wound. And what this whole financial package does is it simply gives more steroids and makes the problem worse. So let me give you a couple examples. We find SEC registration required for municipal finance advisors. So now the people who advise state and local government are supposed to be controlled and regulated by the federal government, something I can't fathom is constitutional under the U.S. Constitution. But you have centralized control of the municipal financial advisors, of the appraisers, of the of a number more control of the insurance industry, more control of the mortgage industry. And so what we're basically saying is the people who did such a good job enforcing against Bernie Madoff, we're now going to give them more power, which makes absolutely no sense, because you're literally saying the government led the engineering of the housing bubble. It engineered the manipulation of the precious metals market. It engineered the housing bubble. And now to clean up and reform from that, we're going to give it more power. Well, how did that power work the last time around? So you're literally giving more power to the people who engineered the last go-round. You're giving them more regulatory power, in many cases, over people, you know, who didn't do anything except do their work and try to survive a bubble. And you're doing it in a way which is going to give more and more power to the wrong people. Let me give you an example. DynCorp is a defense contractor. Lockheed Martin is a defense contractor. And if you look at the federal government, not in terms of 21 separate agencies, but in terms of the data that Lockheed Martin and DynCorp manage, it's quite extraordinary. The last time I looked, and I haven't looked currently, the SEC information systems are run by DynCorp. So recently, the last time I looked, was the New York Stock Exchange. When I read a piece of legislation that says, all these people who haven't had to before are going to have to register with the SEC and give all their portfolio and investment strategy data to the SEC. I don't see that data going to the government. I see that data going to DynCorp and be able to be aggregated with lots of other data managed by DynCorp and their strategic partners. So let me give you an example. And let me before I do this, let me just say the summaries of the Act, which is approximately 1,700 pages, by Monday we will put up on the blog so that you will have our notes and be able to peruse through. We focused on the areas of concern to us and the subscribers. We may miss some areas, but if you want to avoid reading 1,700 pages and are willing to skim about 30, I think it will help you. Again, this is the Housing Act and not the or the House bill and not the what has been agreed to in the Senate. We have yet to see what that is. Okay, so let's say the financial reform package gives massive amounts more data to a small handful of defense contractors who manage all the information systems for the U.S. government. Let's look at that in the context of those same contractors are going to be managing the census data, including GPS targeting that tells them exactly where everybody is. So they're going to have our financial data. They're going to be able to tie that to where we live, and they're going to be able to tie that to a national ID card. And they're going to be able to tie that to our healthcare databases, and they're going to be able to do that in a system where the professionals who are supposed to be helping us, whether it's our CPAs or our doctors or our broker-dealers, are now, thanks to all these packages of reforms, loyal to their enforcement needs and not to us. So they're literally in the process of building the database and information systems infrastructure that you need to do a digital currency. Now, when most people look at what's going on in the federal government and they see, oh, we have a census, oh, we have healthcare reform, oh, we have financial reform, oh, we have a national ID, they see four distinct efforts that are going to be governed by different agencies. That's not what I see. My background is very much sitting in the room with decision makers who talk about how they're going to get more control and as a result of deciding where they want to go, then initiate all sorts of efforts in different areas that are designed to cross-cut and come together in very powerful ways. And if you look at the conditions you need to have a digital currency, putting together a very precise database infrastructure and information systems infrastructure with the requirement that all important personal databases are digital and available to the government, as, for example, healthcare reform would do, and are connected with a requirement to have a national ID, you're talking about the basis of a very, very different kind of world and economy where the centralized control is beyond anything we can imagine. And, again, I would encourage you to go back and read my article, The Data Beast. So my take on the Financial Reform Act is that it's not about financial reform. It's, among other things, about getting the control we need to assert incredible control of the financial system sufficient to get a digital and ultimately a global digital currency. Okay, so very quickly, a few questions. I wanted to also say in our heroes, I mentioned Ron Paul saying the national ID was essentially nuts on Fox News. Great interview. It's up on the blog. And Granny D. Granny D died this week at 89, walked across the country, and has been an activist literally up until her death, died at the age of 100, proof positive that one person can make an enormous difference, including from the ages of 89 to 100. And just a very a wonderful voice for humanity. And ask Catherine a couple of questions. One question about the Free Lakota Bank. I've answered this before. The Free Lakota Bank has no information up on their website about who are their owners, who are their managers, no professional presentation of who and what they are, and, I would avoid it at all costs. Another question on confiscation of gold. It's we've answered. We have a wonderful response on confiscation of gold in the FAQ, but I'll put that question to Franklin in just a moment. One subscriber suggested we delegate health care to state and local government. I couldn't agree more. I think in the process we need to decentralize health care. And yes, I would much prefer to see state and local government involved and things to be very place-based in design rather than federal. So the more we decentralize, the better off. A question about Matt Tabai, the wonderful reporter for Rolling Stone. He says, you know, the problem with Matt is that there's no – he doesn't look at government's role and really hold the government accountable for its responsibility in leading the corruption and the bubble. I think that's an excellent comment. You're right. It's really a, you know, a public-private effort, and sometimes it's hard to figure out who's who, because when you say the government, it's important to understand that there is no government. The government is really run by defense contractors and big banks, and there's lots of cross-cutting. You know, there really is a shadow government, and in fact, there are many of them. You have 9 intelligence agencies and a huge $500 billion a year military infrastructure, lots of different factions, and it's really, John Rappaport called it the fractured kingdom. So it's important to understand that the government's really controlled, not by the government. The president's certainly not in control of the government, especially given how financially dependent it is. So, but I think, you know, trying to give a sense of that Wall Street, Washington, really two sides of the same coin is what I tried to communicate in the Dylan Reed article. And you're right, I think Matt would benefit tremendously from, you know, from integrating more of that into his writing. Finally, there is a very interesting question about whether or not there's been municipal bond corruption in a local area from one of our subscribers, and he asks, can I map out or can I do anything personally about it? Let me just give a couple of comments. It's usually in situations where there is corrupt issuance of municipal bonds, it usually is possible over time to map out the who wins and who loses. You can look at the spreads on the bonds and the economics of where the money went, both the underwriter's discounts and the sort of the trading of the bonds in the secondary market. Who got the money? How was it used? And then the people who awarded that business, over time you can see what jobs they get, where they go, sort of how they fare economically and socially, and how that connects to the people who benefited. So it is possible to map out the financial ecosystems and see things. They may be enough to get formal investigators to investigate. They may not. It is important to understand that depending on who's involved, it can be dangerous. So you want to be very, very careful about how you do it and, you know, and take your time and do it slowly. But I would really caution you to be careful. And finally, somebody recommended that I watch a documentary on the Barnes Foundation. It looks absolutely fascinating. I will attempt to do that. Okay, so now we turn to precious metals. Franklin, are you with us?
I'm here.
Okay, well, what happened?
You know, I had a subscriber to my daily commentary write me this week and say, hey, explain this wild roller coaster ride that we've had the last week in gold. And the truth is, it's not that wild a ride. You know, there's a $40 spread between the high and the low. It's from $1,100 to $1,142.60. So that's a 3.3% difference. It's not that great. You know, I mean, I know it's frustrating. It's especially frustrating when there are critical support levels or resistance levels that gold gets through, and then all of a sudden it falls back down. This is just typical of a, you know, of a market that's correcting, a market in a trading range, It's very, very frustrating. It gets up above critical levels. You think, ah, that's it. It's broken out now. And then it falls back down. And so you nothing.
It's like a two-year-old is still learning to walk.
Right. And so you can't really complain, because in the preceding act, gold went from $681 in November of 2008 to $1,226 in December of 2010. So 13 months to almost double, that's not a bad deal. You know, think about it, put it in other terms, that's $250 to $500 in 13 months. Very few markets do that. So it's just a normal correction, and it is very frustrating. It's very, very frustrating because it gives off a lot of false signals. Now, the thing is, I've been in a quandary since December, because I thought that the market would extend the rally from 1226, that it would make a short correction and then extend the rally. And part of that's due to the seasonals, because normally we get a high in November, December, and then very often a high in March, April, May, but late spring, occasionally in June, but usually it's in late spring. So that's the normal seasonal pattern in gold, and it pretty much holds whether you've got a bull market or a bear market. You get those highs that time of the year, and then you get the low for the year in June, late June or July. Then about the middle of August, the market starts picking up again and rises into October, November, sometimes even December. So that's, we've got that seasonal pattern that's working. But right now, it's hard to tell whether gold's going to extend its rally or literally go sideways for 12 months. And it could certainly do that. That, you know, if you look back at the history of the market, it could certainly do that. But it appears that there is, and I haven't said anything about this, but my friend Bob, the technical genius, sent me a note the other day, and he said, hey, have you noticed there appears to be an upside-down head and shoulders forming in gold? And if you look at the December through today's action, you can see there is an upside-down head and shoulders, which is, of course, a formation of a base from which a market will build another big rally. So that's sort of where we are today. There are all these contrary winds blowing, you know, against each other. For instance, the gold silver ratio has dropped sharply in the last 2 weeks.
It's been remarkable.
Yeah, and what does that normally mean? Well, normally that presages a large rise in silver and in gold, but with the silver rising faster. So will it follow through? I don't know. It's still in the middle of the range. Again, you're waiting for breakouts. But from I've looked at gold, and it appears to me that we've seen the bottom. There was a bottom at 1042, 1044. I don't think it'll go any lower than that. But we may have a good bit of this sideways, you know, this frustrating, very frustrating sideways movement. And it moves sideways and always just a little bit higher. And then suddenly it breaks out and you've got another party going on. So I think you just have to be patient. And if you see gold retreat or silver, then that's the time to go in and pick some more up. But, I wrote to my reader and I said, listen, if you don't like to sweat, don't get out on the field. I mean, that's just this kind of action goes with every market. It doesn't matter what kind of market it is. It goes with every market.
Well, but I used to feel that I understood why markets were doing what they were doing, because it's much more tied to economics. And ever since, the development of derivatives and the use of markets as global economic warfare playing field instead of something related to the real economy, you know, it's so much more political.
Well, it's terribly frustrating,
yeah.
Because you look at a market, I mean, the stock market is the most obvious example. You look at that market, and it makes a technical move that just demands that something else follows it. You know, just 90% of the time, if it does this, it'll do that. For instance, there's a formation on a chart called a rising wedge, and the market trades into this rising wedge or triangle. And 80% of the time, it ought to break out to the downside. It ought to fall down. Instead, it does that in the stock market, and, oh, it goes up instead. Or, oh, something catches it, and it goes up. Well, it just stinks. it just says, nice government men somewhere. You know, I mean, markets don't trade that way. And you see it more in the daily action than you do in the longer term. But you know that they're messing with the market. The only thing is, what I have to keep reminding myself of is, look, they can change things at the margin today, but maybe tomorrow or the next day they won't be able to, because the big tide of the market is moving against them. The tide of the market is moving against them in stocks, and it's moving against them in metals. It's
right.
Moving against them in the dollar. So they can mess with it for today, but they can't mess with it for the end of next week.
One of the things we were talking about this at dinner, I go back and forth every day between what I call the financial blogosphere,
mm-hmm.
and the official reality. So, you know, on one hand, I'm reading Kiplinger and the Wall Street Journal and The Economist, and on the other hand, I'm reading, you know, much more accurate sources of information. But the financial blogosphere is absolutely convinced that the end of the world is coming shortly. We're about to fly off the precipice, that we're going to have, you know, Argentina shock and awe or Russian meltdown or, you know, whatever. And meantime, the Wall Street Journal and Kiplinger are literally singing, happy days are here. And, you know, it's not that I haven't lived with this for the last 10 years, as have we all. But here's really the question. You know, I'm still a fervent believer in slow burn, but I want to get your take on this. Could we be closer to a crash? Am I just being, what do you think?
Well, I think the world has become more and more hollow, and so the people who manipulate markets, like the Exchange Stabilization Fund, the federal government, they are more and more concerned with one number at the end of the day. For instance, how does the Dow finish the day? How does the S&P finish the day? How does gold finish the day? Well, that's really a hollow effort, because, as I said before, you can do that for a day. You may be able to do it for a week, but you can't go against the weight of the market forever. There's so many, you know, we've been doing this, the United States has been doing this for nearly 100 years. That is, we've had a financial system that creates the tapeworm economy, to use your phrase, which is a great phrase, by the way. We've had this for 100 years. How many inequities, how many malinvestments, how many things have to be created? How many illnesses have been built in that have to be created? So I think you could have a breakdown at any time, but there's so much inertia for stability. There's so much
right.
inertia for, hey, let's not give up. Let's go on and work another hour. You
right.
know, let's
right.
let's try to make it work today.
Well, to me, there are two incredible sources of wealth that just pop out each year. And one is the harvest. In other words, every year, we live in a country with incredible, we are a breadbasket.
Mm-hmm.
Our agricultural production is unbelievable, and every year we produce an enormous amount of, another harvest comes out of the ground, and it's a huge gift. And then the other thing is the vast majority of people get up every morning, go back in, and have a real commitment to keeping things going, no matter how much they get drained by inflation or any of these other policies.
That's exactly right.
Right, it's quite extraordinary. I've said I think that 80 to 90% chance of slow burn this year, and I continue to believe that that's the case. The question is, how much force, if you look at what they did to get money coming back into U.S. mutual funds, you know, the nature of the game has become much more nasty, whether it's the safety wars that we're seeing Toyota and the car companies go through, or it's the Greek financial crisis. It's becoming a meaner and meaner game. And in many respects, whether it's slow burn or crash, it's the same transition we all need to go through. we all need to shift away from dependency on the government. I wanted to report, Franklin, I gave a speech in Memphis to the Memphis chapter of CPAs,
mm-hmm.
Tennessee Society of CPAs, and in my conversation with a variety of them before and after and during the speech, I realized there really is not, and I've seen this among very intelligent, sophisticated financial professionals, there's very little understanding of the extent to which their entire local economy is coming from government.
Mm. Well, you know, that particular area, by the way, you mentioned something earlier about Kansas City having the size of its schools or having the number of schools. In Shelby County, which is Memphis, where Federal Express is located, headquartered, and a number of other large corporations, do you know who the largest employer is?
The school system.
The school system, that's exactly
right.
That's
true for many counties around the country.
Yeah. Yeah.
Many, many counties. And you know, we are all going to go through two budget cycles at the state and local government level now in 2010 and 2011, and we're going to get a real wake-up call in the extent to which our economies are government-driven and what we can move out, you know, do to move out, which is why I really wanted everybody to hear tonight. I set up on the blog Saturday night. I had one of the most gratifying and fun times I've had in a long time, because I dragged you over to Jackson, Tennessee for the Tennesseans for Liberty. It's a wonderful group out of Jackson, Tennessee, that sort of rose up out of the Paul campaign and very focused on the nuts and bolts of, you know, running people for sheriff and county commissioners and looking at the detailed things that you could do at a state and local level. You know, just wonderful, wonderful people. Anyway, Franklin, one of the things I struggle with is how do I explain to folks who haven't been involved in farming and food and agriculture the importance of turning around the food purchases and the food business in a local economy and why buying precious metals is not enough. And you gave a wonderful presentation, and I would love for you just to walk through some of the ideas, you know, that you shared on Saturday night with our listeners tonight.
Well, you know, the first thing was that the USDA estimates that every man, woman, and child in the United States spends about $1,800 a year on food, you know, milk, meat, vegetables. And if you've got $100,000 person population in a county, as Madison County, which is Jackson, does, you're looking at, you know, $180 million that those people spend on food in a year.
Right.
And that's a huge amount of money.
Right.
And the way that economically connects with the people there is that for every dollar in income that the farmer has, as that processes through the economy, it becomes $7 of income for everybody else. So if you can capture, let's say you can capture a $200 million cash flow through the economy on food, for the entire economy, the entire local economy, that becomes $1.4 billion that you have captured for your economy.
Right.
And goodness gracious, you know, is there any economy with 100,000 members that wouldn't profit from an extra $1.4 trillion?
That's an enormous number of jobs.
Oh, God, it's unspeakable. You're talking about, you know, 1,800 farms cash flowing $100,000 a year.
Right.
It's just, you know, and ask any farmer, well, if you could get, you know, cash in hand through the year in a regular flow, $100,000, could you make any money? Of course he can. And then he'll spend that money locally, and that becomes the cash that circulates around the entire economy.
Now, it's interesting because people will say, well, you know, we can't compete with the big agribusiness farming in Chile. I just finished watching a wonderful documentary, The World According to Monsanto. I put it up on the blog. It's up on the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a wonderful description of why you don't want to buy food. I mean, literally, if you don't know where your food is coming from, it's not safe. I mean, we've reached that point.
You know, it was interesting in that Saturday night. You noticed that that I mentioned $10 chickens.
Uh-huh.
And there was one fellow sitting up in the front who came unglued when I said $10 chickens. Nobody's going to pay $10 for a chicken.
Yeah, well, you see his health care bill?
Right. Yeah, exactly. And the thing is that there are two things going on there. Number one, when you taste that chicken, you'll understand that it's worth $10. That's the first thing, because it's not mushy. It tastes like chicken. It's just everything about it says, whoa, this is good for me. And that's the first part of it. But the second part of it is when you realize this is not going to degrade my health,
right,
this is going to enhance my health, then you're willing to pay the money. Sure, you can get a chicken for, I don't know what they're selling for, 40 cents a pound in Walmart or whatever it is. Sure, you can get a chicken like that. And you know what they feed that chicken? Arsenic.
Right.
They feed the chicken, they put arsenic in the chicken food because it makes the chicken gain weight faster. Well, how much arsenic do you want to eat?
Right.
It's just that simple. But
you told the story of the difference between Alabama and Tennessee when it comes to slaughtering chickens.
Mm-hmm.
Could you explain that?
Well, here's an example of how government regulation destroys local economies. The USDA has an exemption for anyone who slaughters 20,000 birds a year or less. In other words, if you slaughter 20,000 birds a year, we don't want to know about you. We're not going to inspect you. We don't care what you do. So in Alabama, the interpretation of that regulation is, hey, you can kill up to 20,000 birds on your farm, and we're not going to bother you. In Tennessee,
I should mention Joel Saladin over in Virginia says he makes about $300,000 to $400,000 a year just doing chicken broilers.
Right. And we ought to mention, too, that 20,000 birds is a huge
That's
number
a huge
of birds.
Number of birds.
Oh, it's an incredible number.
You can feed a lot of people in a community.
Oh, yeah, it's $200,000 worth of chickens. But anyway, in Tennessee, the interpretation, now, let me go back and tell you that there are a lot of people raising chickens in Alabama in an alternative agriculture way, and there's a huge market for that there, because when that happens, when you've got people producing them, there's a feedback cycle between the consumer and the producer, so that more and more people are drawn into that consumer-producer cycle. So anyway, in Alabama, you've got a 20,000 bird exemption. In Tennessee, the way the Tennessee Department of Agriculture interprets it is, you can't kill one single bird and sell it to anybody. You can't do even one. Now, what does that mean? The profit on that bird is about 50%, give or take. So if you sell a $10 bird, that means the farmer's making $5. Well, just figure it out. If he sells, 5,000 chickens a year, that's $25,000 cash, which is $12,500 to his bottom line. Or I'm sorry, it's $25,000 to his bottom line. That's profit. And $50,000 in gross sales. Think about how much that means. It's the difference between living and dying for
a farmer. Well, let's go through milk.
Oh, milk's worse. We went up. Sally Fallon from the Weston A. Price Foundation was really good to help us. We were trying to get a raw milk bill passed, and they asked me to speak. We went up there to talk to the legislature. There were two of us, Sally Fallon and me, and then there were about 35 bureaucrats from the state to stand up and talk about how everybody was going to get poisoned. But I did the numbers, and you figure that you could make from you can sell raw milk for $5 to $8 a gallon. So the difference, what that means is that on 7 cows, a farmer can cash flow, that is gross, from $57,000 to $92,000 a year. On 7 cows, just
okay,
so, 7 cows.
So in Tennessee, we have 20% of the people on food stamps.
Mm-hmm.
And I should just mention, I'm going to talk about Tennessee as an example, but this model works in every county in every state across the country.
Mm-hmm.
So you have 20% of the people getting unemployment insurance. We have counties where 20% of the people, 20 to 25% are unemployed. And literally, they are unemployed and need food stamps because of these rules.
Absolutely.
If you look at, we're talking milk and chicken, but we can go through, all the different food types. And what we're talking about is whether or not we have jobs or literally sit here on the government dole, you know, buying corporate food and getting sick.
Well, let's not stop there, because it's much worse than that. Because the kinds of food that are kept off the market by these regulations are healthful, nutrient-dense foods that actually nourish people.
Right.
They actually feed you and keep you healthy. And what they are suppressed in favor of is foods that are not nutrient-dense, foods that are nutrient-poor, sugar-rich, the same foods that give people obesity, diabetes, high blood pressure, and all the other complex of disease that circulates around and is caused by the modern diet. So there are two things going on here. First of all, with the suppression of local agriculture, what has happened is that the local economy is suppressed, but also the health of the population is suppressed. And so you create all these huge health problems that we wouldn't have if people could get good food.
Okay, so there's a wonderful group called Edible Communities that have started sort of seeding magazines in every, you know, in places all over the country. And if you want to find your local food markets, there's one from Memphis. So I found it to be very useful in terms of identifying sort of local food resources, but then also Weston Price has groups all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And then Anna E. Starr, our head of operations, she's going to be writing about food while I'm on vacation. I'm very excited. We're going to have a food week on the blog. And her family has a wonderful health food store in Kalispell, Montana, Mountain Valley Foods. And what I found, a lot of the food groups you can find, you know, among the great local farmers markets or stores. So there are a lot of ways for people to connect with the local farmers and certainly enjoy the experience. So, you know, to me, Franklin, if we're going, we have to create jobs, and we have to create income locally. And one of the easiest no-brainer things to move local is the food. And so, if we're going to deal with local currencies, we're going to need to deal with local foods. And that brings us to our documentary. Morgan Spurlock, I want to talk a little bit about Supersize Me. I hope you all who are listening have seen it. It's up on the internet. I put it up on the blog. It's available for free. It's about an hour and 40 minutes, and it was made by Morgan Spurlock, who's a wonderful documentary maker in New York, who his girlfriend at the time, now his wife, was a vegetarian vegan chef. And he decided to make a documentary about McDonald's, where he eats at McDonald's for 30 days straight. And the documentary walks through him going to setting up and organizing this process and arranging for a trainer and a nutritionist and doctors to sort of, you know, to help him and document his journey eating at McDonald's for 30 days. And so we watch this wonderful, talented, intelligent young man go through a process from going from very healthy to extremely unhealthy, even having his doctors warn him that he has to stop midway. He can't continue or he might permanently damage his health or die. It's quite extraordinary. And it literally took him, I think, you know, over a year to kind of get his weight back and get rebalanced with the help of his wonderful girlfriend, now wife. And it's extraordinary because it literally shows you, and in combination with the movie we talked about last week, Killer at Large, it literally shows you the extent to which our food supply is intentionally poisoning people and making them sick. At the end of the documentary, they count up how much sugar he has eaten in a month from eating at McDonald's, and they pile the sugar on a table. And it is absolutely, you look at this pile of sugar and you realize this man has been poisoned. It's just absolutely frightening. And, you know, but it's amazing. And the thing that amazes me, Franklin, is here we have a documentary that just describes beyond a shadow of a doubt what this food is going to do to you. And it's been out for years, and people just keep piling in and eating at McDonald's.
That's the astonishing thing. And if you talk to them about food, they say, well, that doesn't affect me. Why should I be worried about that? It's really astounding. I can't figure it out myself.
Well, I'm going to be very interested to see as we go through this. It would be interesting if you look at the what are McDonald's sales every year? Do we have I have no idea what they are.
Billions of dollars.
Billions.
Yeah.
Can you imagine if those purchases went to local farmers?
Oh, it's astonishing. Yeah, you see what you're talking about are businesses and employment that would be huge compared to what we have. The government talks about creating jobs. If we simply began to buy food from local farmers, nobody'd have to worry about creating jobs. We'd be creating them.
Well, and of course, then there are lots of other local jobs that could be moved.
Oh, well, they all come after that. Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
So you move the food, and then suddenly you can afford to, install lots more solar and wind and become much more energy self-reliant.
Oh, don't forget about the arts, too.
Right.
Now, all of a sudden, there's a market for local artists, and they appear, too.
Right. It snowballs.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that happened to me over the last week, I hope I wasn't whining during dinner, I've had more and more people lobbying me to support a march on Washington, a boycott or strike, all sorts of other actions which put pressure on the federal government and demand that the federal government give us jobs. And as I can't think of any idea which is a bigger waste of our time and money than such an effort. And in fact, what I described to you during dinner is Gandhi's March to the Sea, which was the salt march in India, where he said, the British had created a monopoly on salt, which people needed for their businesses and for their, for food and health and food storage and all sorts of things. And Gandhi just said, well, something? Pooey to you. We're just going to march to the sea and get our own salt, and ignore your cartel. We bust your monopoly. And the reason I love the salt march to the sea, and I think it's one of the models we need to aspire to, is I wanted you to walk through the chicken and milk example, not because I wanted all of the Salieri Report subscribers to go out and become dairy farmers, but because it's thousands of little things like that can change and transform our situation. We control the bank deposits. We control the investments. We control where we purchase, who we purchase from. We have the power to shift trillions and trillions of dollars. And that's where our power comes from. And our power, Franklin, is not just taking it away from the bad guys. It's giving it to the good guys. You and I know how many wonderful farmers, how many wonderful food stores, how many wonderful solar energy installers, how many wonderful artists. There are thousands of businesses and thousands of people. If that money starts to shift into them, they have the power to do much, much more.
Absolutely.
Right.
Certainly. Yeah, here's the thing. If they came to you and they said, give me $10,000, you would say, wait, I can't do that. But you're going to spend that much money on what they produce this year. But you're going to spend it with the person who's your enemy.
Right.
Or if enemy is too strong a word.
No, I think enemy is a very appropriate word.
Yeah. So here you have it in your power to put that money in their hands and to benefit yourself at the same time, to get more for your money. And it just doesn't make any sense that we keep working against ourselves. But, Catherine, I have to tell you something. I've been literally all over the country talking about revitalizing local economies doing business with local people, doing business with buying your food from local producers. And people have a hard time getting it. They just have a hard time getting it. I don't know if they're so used to going to McDonald's, if they're fatalistic about it, or if they think, well, it's just a little thing. It's not, my little act is not going to make a difference. Your little act is going to make a huge difference.
It's going to make a huge difference. And ultimately, it's going to make a huge difference to you. I've said it before. Once I hit a tipping point of where I was spending my money, my whole life changed, and it's almost spiritual. You know, there's just a lot more degrees of separation between the bad guys and you. Suddenly you're doing business with all sorts of people who don't steal and cheat, you know. And no, it just, it's very...
I'm just trying to figure out why you said it's almost spiritual. because there is, of course, you know, we're creatures of body and spirit, and everything we do goes together. And if you're betraying your body, then you're betraying your spirit at
yep.
the same time.
Yep. Well, quickly before we close, I just wanted to bring up your old friend Confiscation. We did get a question about, can my gold be confiscated? I've reminded everybody there's a very detailed, lengthy response in the frequently asked questions. If you go back to the Precious Metals Market Report library, it's just look in the frequently asked questions. It's a great thing. But maybe, Franklin, if you could give us just 1 minute on confiscation.
Okay, confiscation won't happen. How about just, we can stop there, but let me go deeper into it and say, again, Willie Horton, somebody asked the great bank robber in the 30s, Willie Horton, why do you rob banks? And he said, because that's where the money is. So it's the same way. There's $16 billion, $16 trillion in IRAs and 401k.
No, actually, there's $16 trillion in retirement savings. It's $3.6 trillion. In 401ks and IRAs.
All right. Well, that's about $16 trillion altogether. So
right.
That's where the money is. That's where they will go to steal the money. That's where they'll go to find a source for inflation, as they did to gold in the 1930s. But the world is so different now that gold is not involved in that picture. The money is not there. So there's just very little likelihood they're going to do that.
And I would just like to point out, we did a great interview with Sheriff Richard Mack, and I would encourage you to listen to it in detail. But one of the things we point out, if your state is strong on 10th Amendment and your sheriff is strong on Constitution, literally the feds have no power to confiscate within your sheriff's jurisdiction, within your county.
Exactly.
Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, coming up next, March 18th, a wonderful conversation with James Norman, former editor at Forbes, reporter at Business Week, and contributing editor at Platts Oil Journal, oil market expert. We'll be talking about the oil card and the use of oil prices in the oil market as economic warfare, particularly with Russia and China. On April 1st, first quarter wrap-up, I'll be looking back at our what happened in the first quarter? What does it mean? What's going to come up in the second quarter? Catherine Albrecht is going to be with us later in April. She's the author of Spy Chips. We'll be looking at what this national ID card proposal is, what it means to you, and the effort to put more and more chip kind of technology in everything around you. And also, we're working hard to find a really excellent person on identity theft. Stay tuned for more of that. Until then, you're in our prayers. Please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.